This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. So you befriend a Rockefeller, Clark Rockefeller, and suddenly you have a connection to this world of wealth and privilege. Or so you think, until finding out your new friend is an imposter. Not only an imposter, but a murderer. This is what happened to Walter Kern. And Kern's a pretty smart guy. He's a journalist and the author of two novels that have been adapted into films, Up in the Air and Thumbsucker. Kern tells the story of how he was deceived and what the consequences were in his new memoir, Blood Will Out. Here's some backstory. Clark Rockefeller was just one of several identities assumed by Christian Karl Gerhardt's writer, a German national. He murdered his landlady's son in 1985, but wasn't charged with the murder until 2011. He was convicted last August and is now serving a 27-year prison term. Kern met the man, who called himself Clark Rockefeller, in 1998, and they remained friends until Rockefeller was unmasked. Terry spoke with Walter Kern earlier this month.
Walter Kern, welcome back to Fresh Air. What a really what a really interesting book, and what a really bizarre position you were in. I want you to start by doing a reading from the book, and this is a reading that takes place during the trial. So you can set it up for us or just start the reading.
Well, I think I'll just start it because I think it explains itself.
Because it's about how you were feeling.
Yeah, it's about how I was feeling at Gerhardt's writer's murder trial. As I sat there looking at my old friend being tried for a horrible murder. That Clark was guilty, I had little doubt. 28 years ago, here in California, he'd killed his landlady's adopted son, and his life ever since had been a masquerade. The trial would permit the prosecution to color in and substantiate this story, but I already knew it in outline and found it credible. What I didn't find credible anymore was me. When I'd learned that Clark might be a murderer and instinctively found the notion plausible, the effect on me was Galilean. It humbled me. It reoriented everything. It revealed to me the size and power of my ignorance and vanity. About 2 hours into jury selection, while scrutinizing another would-be juror, Clark glanced to the side and saw me sitting there. I nodded at him. I thought he might nod back. I was, after all, a face from better days. He sneered at me instead, arching his eyebrows, wrinkling his nose, and twisting up his lips into a horrible, prissy little knot. The look was vicious and contemptuous and indicated that he viewed my presence as a betrayal of our relationship, as conduct unbecoming in a gentleman. I viewed things differently, of course. To me, our relationship was the betrayal, nor did I care anymore to be a gentleman. For the rest of the trial, until we met again, he pretended that I wasn't there.
That's Walter Kern reading from his new book, Blood Will Out. This is not a novel. This is the true story of someone who was his friend who turned out to be an imposter and a murderer. Would you describe the murder?
Yeah. In 1985, February, I'm going to call him Clark. Clark was living next door to an old lady who had a big sort of mansion-like house in San Marino, California. And he was living in the guest house. And she had a son in his 20s named John Sohus, who had just gotten married to a wife, Linda Sohus. And they were living in the main house. Well, somehow, in a way that's never really been made clear because the investigation has big holes in it, Clark murdered John Sohus. We've never found Linda. Her body has never turned up. He cut him up, perhaps using a chainsaw that he'd borrowed from a neighbor. There was testimony about a chainsaw being borrowed. Wrapped him in some kind of plastic wrap, cut him into three pieces with his clothes on, then put the body parts into plastic book bags and grocery bags and buried them in the yard between the guest house and the mother's house. He then covered the grave, and in a couple of months' time, sometime after the murder, he held a card party, a Trivial Pursuit game, actually, next to the grave, outdoor, served iced tea. One of the guests looked down, saw the dirt on the ground, and said, you know, what's all that? And he told them, well, there have been plumbing problems in the yard. That body wasn't found for 9 years until that yard was excavated for a swimming pool. And when it was, the body was found, the man who had been living in that guest house had disappeared. He'd called himself Christopher Chichester at the time of the murder, a British baronet. But what no one knew was that he was now living in New York City as Clark Rockefeller.
A member of the Rockefeller family, he said.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, what other Rockefellers are there? You know, when I met him, of course, he was living under this guise, and I didn't think to ask which Rockefellers, you know.
Oh, you just assumed.
I just assumed. I assumed so much, and he knew I would assume it, you know. He knew I'd assume the best. I'd assume that he was powerful, wealthy. He did a lot to persuade me that he was, and he knew that people would want to get close to him, and he was right about me.
And you never Googled him.
Well, let's put it this way, Terry. You know. Okay, let's look at it this way. In 1998, Google hadn't been invented.
Okay,
there were search engines.
There was
no Google.
Right. Okay.
Later, by 2000, in the mid-2000s, when I might have Googled him, I did just to see which Rockefeller branch he came from, and it was all very murky. There were Clark was a name associated with the Rockefellers. There was a Mary Clark Rockefeller, and so on and so on. There was no Clark Rockefeller specifically, but I thought anybody this rich and powerful will have obscured their identity on the internet, you know. So it didn't bother me much.
Great. So you kind of fill in the blanks for him in a way.
Clark, here is the secret of a master manipulator and liar. They leave lots of blanks for you to fill in. For example, when he was living in San Marino and pretending to be a British aristocrat, and this came out at the trial, he told one young woman, oh, you know, I have an aunt in England. Her name's Elizabeth. Then at another point, he said, I have to go visit my family in Windsor. And this person thought, oh, my Lord, he's related to the Queen. The Queen's named Elizabeth, and she lives in Windsor. He was always doing that. He was always dropping breadcrumbs because he knew that if you put the story together in your own mind, you'd be more convinced by it than if he told you the whole story.
So let's talk about how you became involved with him in the first place.
Yeah.
And it was through a dog whose spine had been broken in an accident, and the dog had been put up for an adoption on a dog website. And and Clark Rockefeller, as he was calling himself then, wanted to adopt it. So explain how that kind of came around to involving you.
I'm living in Montana. My wife is the head of the local Humane Society in Livingston, Montana. They get in a dog that has been run over by a car and is in a wheelchair. Back legs don't work. They put it up for adoption on the internet, and somebody named Clark Rockefeller from New York City contacts them and says he'd love to take care of the dog. It's a Gordon Setter, his favorite breed. He wants to adopt it. He has another Gordon Setter, just one problem. How do we get the dog to him? Because he doesn't drive. He has no driver's license. And his private plane's off with his wife in China that summer. The Humane Society comes to me knowing that I'd lived in New York and gone to Princeton, you know, Mr. Fancy Ivy League. Maybe you can talk to this Rockefeller character, they asked me. So I get on the phone with him. And once I was on the phone with him for half an hour, I basically had to meet him in person. And he was just so eccentric, so strange. I drove this dog from Montana in a pickup truck to New York City. Actually, I didn't get all the way. I got to Minneapolis and I flew the rest of the way because driving a crippled dog in 90-degree heat across the plains in the summer was enough to give me a nervous breakdown, and I had to fly the last part of the way.
He told you he lived next door to Tony Bennett, which I don't think would be unimaginable. Tony Bennett's kind of famous in Manhattan for just being out and about a lot. It's right. not like he lives in a special castle or anything.
Not only did he tell me he lived next door to Tony Bennett, he told me that one of the reasons that he should be the adoptive owner of this dog was that Tony Bennett would come over and sing to the dog to calm it and help in its healing, you know.
The first time you found out that he had done something terribly wrong was before anybody knew about the murder. Mm-hmm. But he had, it turned out, kidnapped his daughter. You had mm-hmm. met, when you first met him, he was married. He had a young daughter. You'd met the mm-hmm. daughter. Tell us about the kidnapping.
In 2008, Clark abducted his daughter on the street in Boston after a custody hearing. He disappeared with her, and the nationwide Amber Alert was issued.
So this is 10 years after you first met him.
10 years after I first met him. In the year before the kidnapping, I'd been talking to him on the phone a lot. We were both divorced. We both didn't see our kids as much as we wanted to. He wasn't seeing his daughter almost at all. And I'd really let him cry on my shoulder for about a year about his grief over his child. So I turn on the radio or TV or internet, I can't remember which, in 2008, and see that there's a nationwide manhunt on for Clark Rockefeller. He's taken his daughter. And I thought, oh my Lord, he snapped. You know, his heart broke and he snapped and he took her. Well, by the time he was caught, the Rockefeller family was saying, he's not a Rockefeller. We don't know who he is. And I thought they were lying. I thought they were disavowing somebody who'd sort of besmirched their name, you know, maybe a bastard child of the family or something. You know, then within a few weeks, it was clear he was a suspect in this gruesome, horrible murder from 1985. And by that time, my denial was breaking. But when I heard the details of the murder, something about them made me think back on our relationship and what I knew of him and convinced me suddenly in one fell swoop that he was guilty and that I had been completely fooled.
What made you think that?
Thinking
back on your relationship.
Thinking back on our relationship, okay, so the circumstances of the murder were these. He was living in this guest house and passing himself off as a British aristocrat and so on. At one point when I knew him, he had asked if he could come live at my ranch in Montana. And he said, you know, I can stay with you, right? And I said, we don't have any room. And he said, do you have a garage or a little guest house? And I said, yeah. He said, well, I used to live in one of those, and I've never been happier in all my life. Well, when I heard the murder story on the radio, it was clear that the murderer had lived in this little guest house, and his suggestion that he come live in mine lined up with that detail, and it was like a thunderclap.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Walter Kern, and he's known for the novels Thumbsucker and Up in the Air, both of which were adapted into films. His new book is a memoir called Blood Will Out, The True Story of a Murder, a Mystery, and a Masquerade. And the murderer that this is about somebody who went by the name of Clark Rockefeller and became a friend of Walter Kern's. So let's talk a little bit about the trial. You decide
yes.
to go to the trial, which was in Los Angeles. You live in Montana.
Yeah, a year ago the trial began.
What was it like the first time you made eye contact? You made allusion to that in the reading that you did at the beginning of our interview. But just tell us a little bit more about, you know, did he look like the same person? Now that he was no longer pretending to be Clark Rockefeller, did something change about his face and demeanor? Also, he'd been in jail for 4 years, and that probably isn't good for your
the
looks
complexion.
Or your posture. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Well, here's the deal. I sit down in that courtroom a year ago in Los Angeles, a courtroom that's out of like the show Dragnet or some sort of film noir, very, you know, very austere and hard boiled. And in walks, in shackles and, you know, or handcuffs, my old friend Clark Rockefeller. About he looked like hell. You know, He had dyed his hair during the time I knew him, a kind of reddish blonde. The dye was out. His hair was gray. His skin looked ashen. You couldn't tell if he'd gained weight or lost weight. The weight had all redistributed itself. And he sits down, and here's a guy who I last saw in a mansion in New Hampshire or in a private club in Manhattan, and he looked like some kind of left out in the rain, sad, broken spirit. But he had a fierce look in his face, like a feral kind of wild animal look as he sat there. And I thought, wow, how the mighty have fallen. You don't get that kind of revenge too often. Somebody who's fooled you, you get to go to their murder trial.
Right. You mentioned you met him at a mansion and a private club. How did he get access to those things if he wasn't really Clark Rockefeller and if he didn't really have money?
Terry, this book is a meditation to a large degree on the social contract and how so much of what people appear to be is based on what they say they are or what other people say they are. He'd go to a party at a yacht club, say, in Connecticut. This is how it worked. Somehow he'd get to the party. No one would, bar him at the door. He'd be dressed right. He'd tell people he was a Rockefeller. He'd make friends with them. He'd get in that club, and then he'd get reciprocity at other clubs because other clubs trusted that clubs like them had good members. And basically, through this series of references, he would expand his circle larger and larger and soon have access to everything. He was on the board of directors of one of the most exclusive private clubs in Boston. His name was on the wall. He walked into Kidder Peabody, the bond firm in downtown New York City, and got a job selling bonds off the street. An accent sounding sort of like Katharine Hepburn's cousin. That's what I say in the book. A monogrammed shirt and the right shoes will get you everywhere, apparently.
So you're in court. He's exposed now. He's in prison. He's on trial for murder. And you're hearing all these pieces of the story that you couldn't possibly have known about before.
Yes.
And suddenly, you're making sense of things. Give us an example of something that you learned through the trial where you said, now I get it.
Well, I'll give you a very personal example. Somebody who had been his neighbor up in Cornish, New Hampshire, testified that he used to tell them about his ranch in Montana and describe it to him. And I realized that the only ranch in Montana Clark ever knew about was the one that I owned and talked to him about. And I realized that what Clark did was he took examples, stories from his friends, and then he'd carry them across and tell them to his other friends as though they were his own story. So in other words, he'd pump me for information about what it was like to have a ranch in Montana. And then he'd go to somebody who he knew separately from me and talk about his ranch in Montana. And I saw exactly the method that he used to make himself credible. He borrowed everybody's clothes and wore them in front of others as though they were his own.
And one other example of how he patterned himself, how he borrowed things. He was writing a series of novels, or so he said, based on episodes of Star Trek, the TV series.
Okay, so in 2002, I go to his house in New Hampshire. He lures me out there by saying he's friends with J.D. Salinger, who does indeed live in that same town at the time. Maybe we'll meet him. So I come out and stay in Cornish at this house, and he says he wants me to help edit his novels. He wants me to come out so we can talk about maybe editing his novels, but he won't tell me what his novels are about. I spend this horrible weekend with him in this cold, drafty house and sleeping on this crappy mattress, and I'm so sick of him. Finally, I say, what are these novels you've written? He says, well, they're adaptations of my favorite episodes of Star Trek. And I said, Star Trek? Like I was incredulous. And he said, oh, I understand. No, not the original Star Trek, the far superior sequel, Star Trek The Next Generation. he always preferred the sequel. He always preferred the copy. He always preferred, you know, he said he was a producer to some people of Alfred Hitchcock Presents, not the original series from the 60s that we all remember, but some revival of it in the 80s, you know. Strange.
So you, in addition to going to his murder trial, you went to prison to see him, and you talked to him in prison.
Well, yeah.
What did you want to know?
Wow. First of all, I wanted to know if he'd committed the murder. You know, that was obviously the first question I asked him. See, I didn't think I'd be able to talk to him again. The lawyers had had him sequestered for years after the kidnapping and during the murder trial. And it was literally the day of the verdict that another journalist said, you know, you should go talk to him. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, he's fired his lawyers. He's in the jail in downtown L.A., a mile from here. He'll want visitors. So a week later, there I am sitting, looking at him through a glass panel. And I said, Clark, did you commit the murders? And he's like, oh, that, of course not, you know. He basically told me it was a frame job. And I asked him, well, then why did you leave California so suddenly after the murders? And he said, well, Walter, as you know, I wanted to be a screenwriter, and I showed my screenplays to a famous director, Robert Wise, and he told me, Clark, you have industry but no talent. And so I got in my car, which happened to be the victim's truck, and drove away from Los Angeles like so many aspirants before me. You know, that he had that story right at hand. The other weird thing he told me was that if I doubted the story about why he'd left Los Angeles, I could ask Charlton Heston. He said, because I was in screening with Charlton Heston the next day, and I told him about the meeting with Wise. I said, Charlton Heston's dead, Clark. And he said, oh, darn.
Wow. So, one of the questions you asked him was, how did he manipulate so many people?
Yeah, I said, if you're not going to confess to murder, can you at least explain to me how you manipulated so many people? And he said, the answer's easy. Three words, vanity, vanity, vanity. And then he explained that what he did was he took your sort of ideal conception of yourself and he played it back to you. You know, he removed your feelings of self-doubt and insecurity by accepting you as the person you wished you were. And wow, that was the truth. That was the one time he told me the truth.
And how does that apply to you?
Well, I mean, I grew up in a little town in Minnesota, 500 people. I went out to Princeton, and I wasn't very well accepted out there by the fancy folks of Princeton University, I felt. I came away bruised and feeling rejected. You know, later on in life, when this Rockefeller comes along and wants to be my friend, I kind of felt like a nice feeling after the bad feeling. He knew that I had insecurities, like every human being. He knew that I wouldn't mind having a drink in a fancy private club and so on. So he played on my own lack of self-esteem, as it were.
What is his psychological evaluation?
Well, you know, he had expert witnesses in his kidnapping trial try to argue that he was insane. So he cooperated with an insanity defense that he didn't use in the murder trial. And everybody looked through his childhood, trying to find the traumas that would have caused him to be crazy and so on. And they didn't do a very convincing job. Nothing all that bad happened to him as a kid. In fact, if you investigate his childhood, he was always kind of a bully and a meanie. And I think he was always this way. The nature of his sociopathy to me is that he has no self. Everything that he does is copied. Everything he does is emulated. I call him in the book a cannibal of souls. You know, John Sohus was a Star Trek fanatic, the guy he killed. Clark showed no interest in Star Trek before he killed him, but afterwards, he was the number one Star Trek fan. It was as though he assumed his victim's hobby and went about, you know, as though it was his own. In the same way he pretended to own a ranch in Montana, he became a Trekkie after he murdered a Trekkie.
Walter Kern's new memoir is called Blood Will Out. You'll find a longer version of his conversation with Terry online at freshair.npr.org. Our classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz is also a poet. Recently, he sent us a link to a new poem he wrote about friendship and loss that was posted on the website poets.org, which is run by the Academy of American Poets. We asked him to read it for us.
This is a poem I wish I hadn't needed to write. Unfortunately, it's all true. I know I'm not the only person in the world who's had a close friend go missing without any explanation, but I'm still heartbroken and totally mystified. To my oldest friend, whose silence is like a death. In today's paper, a story about our high school drama teacher evicted from his Carnegie Hall rooftop apartment made me ache to call you, the only person I know who'd still remember his talent, his good looks, his self-absorption. We'd laugh at what haven't we laughed, then not laugh, wondering what became of him. But I can't call, because I don't know what became of you. After 60 years, with no explanation, you're suddenly not there, gone, phone disconnected. I was afraid you might be dead, but you're not dead. You've left, your landlord says. He has your new unlisted number, but insists on respecting your privacy. I located your oldest son, who refuses to tell me anything except that you're alive and not ill. Your ex-wife ignores my letters. What's happened? Are you in trouble? Something you've done? Something I've done? We used to tell each other everything. Our automatic reference points to childhood pranks, secret codes, and sexual experiments. How many decades since we started singing each other happy birthday every birthday? Your last uninhibited rendition is still on my voicemail. How often have we exchanged our mutual gratitude, the easy, unthinking kindnesses of long friendship. This mysterious silence isn't kind. It keeps me up at night, bewildered at some stage of grief. Would your actual death be easier to bear? I crave your laugh, your quirky takes, your latest comedy of errors. When one's friends hate each other, Pound wrote near the end of his life, how can there be peace in the world? We loved each other. Why am I dead to you? Our birthdays are looming. The older I get, the less and less I understand this world and the people in it.
Lloyd Schwartz teaches in the Creative Writing MFA program at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. His poem, To My Oldest Friend, Whose Silence Is Like a Death, was first featured on poets.org. Coming up, Terry talks with opera singer Delora Zajic, who's been with the Met for 25 years. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. We're going to listen to Terry's interview with opera singer Delora Zajic, who's been with the Met for 25 years. As you'll hear, Terry was surprised when she recently found herself enjoying opera. Here's how she introduced this interview when we aired it earlier this week.
Something I couldn't have predicted happened to me recently. I fell in love with opera. Honestly, I wasn't prepared for it. I'd always avoided opera. That changed after I saw the 2011 film Margaret that included a scene where the characters go to the Met to see an opera. The opera excerpt in the film was so moving, I decided I had to see one myself. It took a while, but eventually I went to the Met in HD, the live Metropolitan Opera performances shown by satellite in movie theaters around the world. I've been hooked ever since. My guest, Dolores Ogic, has sung with the Met for 25 years. She's best known for singing Verdi. I love her voice, and she has interesting things to say about singing and teaching. She's the founder and director of the Institute for Young Dramatic Voices, which is designed for young singers with big or unusual voices. She didn't figure out that she could sing opera until after she was a pre-med student. Let's start with some very dramatic singing featuring Zajic as the gypsy Azucena in Verdi's Il Trovatore. It is one of those great opera plots. Her mother was burned at the stake on the orders of the count, who believed she bewitched his children. To avenge the murder, Azucena throws the count's son into a fire, only to realize that in her blind frenzy, it was her own son she'd burned alive. In this tormented aria, she confesses the truth to her adopted son. This was recorded at the Met in 2009. Zajic, welcome to Fresh Air. I love your singing. I'm very new to opera, but from the very little that I know about opera, I think of the dramatic mezzo-soprano and the parts that I've seen you in as being kind of like a character actor. In most of your roles in opera, you're not the girlfriend, you're the jealous woman. You're not the lovely nymph, you're the witch. You're not the woman having the affair with the king, you're the fortune teller who that woman goes to. You're Lady Macbeth. So do you think of yourself as a character actor in that respect?
I've become one, and I have enjoyed it. The thing is that mezzo-soprano usually gets the designation of that kind of character in an opera. Usually the soprano is the pure ingenue, and then you've got the noble tenor. And it's usually the baritone and the mezzo that have the evil parts, and sometimes it's the bass. And you get to do all these twisted and interesting people. I like doing those kind of people. There's a interesting evolution when you're acting a part like that, and it's takes a lot of in-depth delving into your own self and finding what's in you, and it takes a harsh, objective look at yourself to be able to come to grips with those kinds of roles in the right way, I think.
So what about your range as a dramatic mezzo-soprano?
Well, a dramatic mezzo is very, not quite, but almost a soprano in terms of range. It's a high mezzo, but you have to have low notes.
And you do.
Yes. I've been very fortunate.
Do you understand everything you're singing? I mean, like,
absolutely.
I mean, word for word, as opposed to here's
word
the English translation.
Not only what I'm singing, but what everybody else is singing.
So you have to know a lot of languages,
but mostly
Italian,
to know,
right?
I sing in Italian, Czech, Russian, French, German, English.
Wow. So, do you have a favorite or a most calamitous moment on stage that you would like to share?
Probably the most calamitous incident was the first time that we did Rusalka, and there was a mechanical cat on my shoulder, and I'm trying to find a motivation for saying hop my cat 1,000 times. So we thought, well, it's digging its claws in your shoulder, and I've got a spoon, and I'm mixing stuff in the cauldron. So I hit it on the head, and the head would stop for a second, and then would continue moving, and the tail would keep moving. Well, one day I hit the head too hard, and the head fell off. But the tail kept moving, so I had to do this. I had to finish the scene with this headless cat and the tail kept with a moving tail, and I didn't know what to do with the head, so I just picked it up and threw it in the cauldron with the rest of the stuff. And that got a lot of laughs.
That's funny, because you're the witch in Rusalka.
Yes.
No, it's really an interesting story how you became an opera singer, because you didn't even start singing until you were 22?
Almost 22.
Yeah, so I thought that opera singers were supposed to start singing when they were very young, and even if they weren't training in opera per se, that they were getting some kind of training.
I think that you will find, if you went around and asked all the opera singers at the very top of their profession how old they were when they started, who they studied with, where they studied, you would get so many different answers that there is no one rule fits all. Singers actually used to begin singing at a much younger age than they do now. But I would say, for me, I started late, but it's not unusual. I discovered I had a voice. I wanted to be a pianist when I was 7, and circumstances didn't allow that I studied it.
What does that
mean? So by the time, well, I just, you know, I didn't have access to a piano. So by the time I got to high school, I knew it was too late to be an instrumentalist. So I decided, well, I'll become a doctor and just, you know, sing for fun, or do something for fun in music. And when I was in college, I was in pre-med, and that's when I discovered I had a voice and that I actually had a crack at a singing career. And I decided to take the chance, and this is where I ended up.
Could you demonstrate for us one of the vocal exercises or techniques or something that you learned early on that has helped guide you and help discover the best qualities in your voice?
Well, here's a vocal exercise. It's very old. It's one of the Vidal exercises, and the purpose of it is to connect the support with the focus, because they're inextricably linked. So it's a very strange exercise, but it works. So it goes something like this. Sounds something like that.
It sounds like you're doing it more nasally first, and then more through your throat second?
Yes, it teaches you the difference between nasal and nasality, nasal resonance, which are two different things. And it also helps you isolate what you really need from one thing to the next, so that the focus and the support are connected together so that you get a supported sound.
Is there another example, too, of something that, like, opened up your voice?
Well, opening my jaw. One of the things that I was taught is that a lot of modern singing today is people use their jaws and their lips more than they used to. And they used to do more with their tongue in the past. And so I was taught the older method. And the difference would be if you go, I'm going to do it the wrong way first, or what some people consider the right way today, and then I'm going to sing the way I do it, which is an older school. So the first way is and then my way would be
well, that's a really big difference. And the second way, the way you do it is darker, fuller, more resonant?
Well, the second way, I don't use my lips. I use my tongue to create the vowels.
Uh-huh. Let's hear some more music. I want to play something from your album, The Art of the Dramatic Mezzo-Soprano. And I thought we could hear from the Verdi opera, Don Carlo, the aria that you're saying, O Don Fatale. Tell us something about this aria.
Well, this is basically where she curses her fatal gift that got her into trouble, her vanity and her beauty, and She basically is bemoaning the fact that she's got to go to a convent. She's been given the choice of exile or the convent. And the reason for this is that she incriminated the queen by putting a portrait of Don Carlo in her jewelry box, which her husband, Philip, found and accused her of infidelity. And for her punishment, she has been given this choice by the queen.
Okay, so this is Dolora Zajic, and we'll hear Charles Rosencrantz conducting the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra. Dolora Zajic from her album The Art of the Dramatic Mezzo-Soprano, and that is dramatic. One of the things you have to do when you sing, especially with singing the kind of powerhouse stuff that you do, you have to learn how to relax your tongue and your jaw. And it's almost counterintuitive, because I think usually if you're doing something that requires a lot of effort, you just kind of naturally tense up. I'm not saying you should tense up, but it's kind of what people do. And probably for untrained singers, it's the same thing, that you just kind of like tense up. How did you learn to not tense up and to
you
keep?
You just don't.
Sure, that's easier said than done.
It is easier said than done, but that's exactly what you do. You learn to let go and stop trying to do too many things and figure out, isolate what you really need in order to function. A perfect example, if you compare a amateur weightlifter with a professional one, the amateur one, his neck is straining and he's using all these extra muscles and he's grunting and all kinds of things. And if you look at a professional, his whole body is relaxed, even the hand that is holding the weight. But he will be exercising only the muscles that are meant to be worked. And that's the difference that you find, because they're very specific, because they want to develop that particular set of muscles over, say, this set of muscles. So what they do is they've learned how to isolate. And that's the real key.
One of the exercises you give some of your students is, it kind of sounds to me like Mongolian throat singing.
Yeah, it is. It's the Kumi style. And what we've discovered is, because it focuses on isolating resonances, is it teaches them about focusing resonance and formants and connecting that with support immediately. It speeds up the learning process tremendously. I had no idea it would speed things up so quickly.
Can you demonstrate for us what it is? Not all of our listeners will know.
Well, what you do is you have a fundamental pitch, and then with your tongue, the middle of your tongue, you bring out different resonances, different pitches. So an example would be this. Anyway, that's a sample.
No, that's wonderful. And the overtones that you get from that are so unusual and eerie. And so what does that teach you? And do you want overtones like that when you're singing?
What it teaches you is that resonance is all manipulated between the middle of the tongue and the hard palate. That's where all the work takes place. Now, you can use sensing devices, but they're not. It's not doing something. I mean, some people say sing in the masks, put it out in front of your face. There are many different, sing like there's a spot between your eyes. These all focus on sensations. And they're useful, but it's only part of the process. And people have different sensations. I mean, somebody might not feel it between the eyes, but they might feel it in a different part of their body. And they're not always reliable. They shift around on you. But hearing focus is always, you'll always hear it the same way. So when it comes to focus, you have to shift the gyroscope to the ear. When people say that someone is listening to themselves too much, they're usually talking about other things, like they're slowing it down and they're not keeping up the beat, or they are or they've gone into the back of their mouth and it sounds big on the inside, but there's no size on the outside, and it's actually got less focus. So focus is something you have to hear in a very specific way.
So you're in your early 60s now. How long do you think you'll be able to sing professionally?
Well, I probably got 5 years of major roles at this present level, and then maybe some featured medium-sized roles for another 5 to 10 years after that, if I choose to do that. That's just the nature of the beast. It's not happening now. I don't want people to think that all of a sudden it's happening now. I just see the approaching line coming. That's all.
Right.
And I want to leave in my prime. I don't want to leave a sorry spectacle before people. I want to leave at a respectable level.
Opera singer Delora Zajic, who's been with the Metropolitan Opera for 25 years. You'll find a longer version of her conversation with Terry online at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Saman, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer for online media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.